All right, everybody, welcome to Conspiracy Bingo. I'm producer Dave. You can find me damn near anywhere except YouTube, because we got kicked off of there because we apparently spread misinformation. Tonight, we're doing a little something different during the first hour, trying to do this a little more often, have an interview. I got Christopher Connor here joining me. You know him as a QAnon or Professor QAnon in the chat. You're an author and an associate professor at the University of Missouri. Is that right?
Damn, you make me sound all professional and stuff. But yes, that's true. Yeah.
Well, cool. I'm glad you joined me, and it's nice to have you in our community here. We like having you in chat, and now it's even better to have you on the show.
Yeah, well, you know, I hope we can unpack some of this stuff, you know, using kind of a sociological framework. I'm excited.
Yeah, me too, because I am not a sociologist, so you'll have to forgive me if I ask dumb questions.
I teach undergrad, so anything you ask me will be just fine.
I bet some of them undergrads you have are sharp as a whip and are brighter than I am.
No, there's some good ones, but yeah, no. I became interested in QAnon because, you know, I started to see a lot of different people in my life suddenly gravitate towards this thing living out here in rural Missouri. And also it kind of fit nicely within this kind of broader framework of what I'm studying, which is how the internet basically is, I don't want to say here, but damaging our society, right? So everything from dating apps to, you know, our public square. And so for me, this is like a kind of a goldmine, academically speaking.
Yeah. I have a, I've talked to a couple people about QAnon. I had three of the people so far from the Q Origins project on, and every time I do, I feel like I get a completely different take on it from completely different people doing completely different things, and that's real good, because my take on it is I've just been trolling conspiracy theorists since like AOL. So I mean, you know, it's definitely good to get people on who are doing research, who are doing academic work on it and whatnot. And that's something that this channel was kind of missing at the beginning. And as for whatever reason, people start to like me more and more. I don't know. Maybe they don't read my Twitter. I'm able to get more and better guests. But you came along as a part of the community at first, which is really, really cool. Also, Kunsterfuge Robert came along as part of the community first and hooked me up with the Q Origins project. So I'm just really thankful to everybody in the community for bringing their friends over, and we're starting to get better interviews. I'm already assuming this is going to be a good interview because, I don't know, I read your paper. Not only did I read your paper, I printed the fucking thing out on paper to read it.
Ooh, fancy.
No, fancy. I just don't like reading anything long on a computer, so I printed it out.
No, I'm the same way. I can't read anything unless it's like in my hands. There's something about that new paper smell I love. I don't know.
Yeah, if it's just like a couple thousand words, I can read it on a computer, but my eyes start to strain and stuff if I read it like on a phone or a computer. So it's printing stuff out's good, and I like to read books as books, although I do have a Kindle, I won't lie. So you said that your interest in QAnon started because people you knew were gravitating towards it. Were they just straight up posting QAnon stuff, or was it like kind of Q adjacent stuff at first, and then you had to figure out what the fuck they were talking about?
Yeah, so this was what I meant when I messaged you and said, you can ask me anything. I got a call one night at like 3 a.m. from a member of my family who, what did she say? She said, basically, I needed to go get rations, a gun, stay away from cities, that there's going to be this riot. And she started talking about what I came to know as the 10 days of darkness. So this is like right before January 6th. And, you know, I could tell something was happening in the air. And so I get this call and I'm like, what is going on? And, you know, I started following, you know, the rabbit hole, if you will, and found out that, you know, there's this thing called QAnon, and basically confirmed my suspicions that there were people in my family who had gravitated towards this conspiracy theory. And then, of course, like any academic, the first thing we do is throw ourselves into our work when our lives go to crap. And so basically, I wanted to understand like how it is, because this individual is a fairly well-educated person. They are actually in higher ed. And I was like, how is it that somebody so smart could become attracted to this. And what did it for me was really, I showed her the images, the live stream from the Vatican, because she was rambling that basically the Vatican had been taken over by Trump's army or some nonsense. And she couldn't believe what, you know, the evidence. And so I realized then that this was something that needed to be looked at with a little closer eye.
That's I've heard that from a lot of people. On that family stuff, I'm pretty fortunate. My family is not prone to conspiracism, but that may just be a function of the fact that our family is just basically what we would call the nuclear family. I don't have like close contact with like extended family. It's like me, my mom, my dad, and my sister. Like, so I don't know what the extended family's up to. And I'm afraid to look, but I also don't like add family on social media. If the people in my family want to get in touch with me, they can get in touch with me. I don't need to have them in my Facebook. The sort of prepping thing for the apocalypse and the fear of cities, that's not new, right? That's not exclusive to QAnon. And that's, if somebody asked me the properties of QAnon, I wouldn't necessarily say that those things would come to my mind first if I was going to describe it. But then that 10 days of darkness thing is a QAnon thing. And for the sake of anybody maybe who doesn't know what it is, can you briefly explain what the 10 days of darkness is?
Oh gosh. The 10 days of darkness, I used to know this like right off the top of my head, but it's basically, the coming storm, right? That there'll be these 10 days of darkness where Trump, wipes out our ability to communicate with each other. And the only way that we're going to be able to communicate is through the emergency broadcast system. When that first kind of hit, people were sending out instructions on how to make sure their iPhone didn't update so that they, would be able to communicate with Trump, and that he was going to send orders basically through the emergency broadcast system, and that he was going to basically issue all these indictments and subpoenas, and that we would probably be without power, was kind of the version of it that I heard. And that another version of it said that there was going to be people, in particular people of color, coming into rural areas, and that they were going to start killing white people, which is just absolute nonsense. And so I've heard some really interesting versions of this that maybe some other people haven't.
Right. My thing on the 10 days of darkness, and I didn't look into it too much, by the time the 10 days of darkness thing had happened, Q had stopped posting, and I had more or less moved on from covering Q content, also because it got mostly like kicked off of social media. And strangely enough, I was afraid of getting kicked off of things for running too much QAnon stuff. But my understanding was that social media and or the internet would be shut down, except for the Anons would have some special access to it. And that was like the extent of what I understood about it.
Yeah. So again, this is just the version I've heard, is that basically the EMS, emergency broadcast system, would be basically the only means to communicate. And someone I know actually went as far to buy like a CB, like ham radio. And this individual is like an ex military, served in Vietnam War, and I guess has some predilection towards this kind of stuff, like doomsday prepping. He actually went out several weeks before the inauguration and like purchased all the ammo he could find, like thousands of dollars worth of ammo. Why you would need that much ammo is just beyond me. But yeah, there's some people, especially in some of the ruler areas, that take this stuff really seriously, and it's both very scary and very sad.
Well, the thing that's most sad about it to me is, you've watched enough to know that we cover goings on up in Shasta County, and the stuff that's going on up there is crazy. And I feel sorry for the fucking regular ass people that live in, because just you live in a rural community, it's still going to have like a diversity of different kind of people. And like a lot of people move out of the city to kind of get away from the hustle and bustle or the crazy. And then all of a sudden these conspiracy theories take hold in these smaller towns. And it's like whatever they were trying to get out of the city for, it seems like in a lot of cases, this stuff's way more scary. You know, if you buy some property out, you know, kind of out away from the city to kind of just live your life. And then you find out people are basically like preparing for the fucking apocalypse in your community. That's gotta be scary. If you're like a liberal or like apolitical or like, you know, just a regular person who likes to, I don't know, have a garden or, you know, whatever the hobby is. And you had mentioned a ham radio. I know a lot of cool people who are hams. There's a lot of crossover between like open source communities and ham radio, but like people buying it, preparing for the apocalypse. I bet the regular hams are like, oh, what are you doing? Again, it's like, I feel so, like if those people would have gotten onto ham radio and started doing this shit, then again, I'd just feel sorry for the regular ass people on ham radio. I'd be like, oh man, you were a cool kind of hackerish community. And now there's people screaming about the apocalypse on ham radio.
Yeah. You know, and I'm thinking back to, you know, and I was never like really into ham radio, but I knew enough about it and listened to some stuff to know that there was kind of always these kind of, you know, kind of, I don't want to call them whack jobs because I think that's disingenuous. Like, you know, they're real people, but people with some, what were we going to say, fringe beliefs that were always kind of there on ham radio or there, you know, kind of in these recesses of society. For the most part, they were kind of self-contained. What's different, I think, today is social media has brought everybody closer together, at the same time driven us further apart.
It's, you know, it's, first of all, chat is asking, you know, they're talking about how smart people fall for conspiracy theories. And not particularly conspiracy theories, but I guess you'll have to go to my website to find it now. My second interview with John Atack of the Open Minds Foundation, we talked about how people think that folks who join cults are stupid, and that's just not the case. And people who join conspiracy communities, they're not all stupid. That's not the case.
Oh, yeah, the recurring theme that I see with a lot of this stuff is that basically, you know, and again, this comes out of the Frankfurt School stuff.
So you're one of those.
Oh, is that a bad thing?
No, I'm just no. It's the cultural Marxism discourse that was going around a couple of years ago.
Yeah. So, you know, under late stage capitalism, the Frankfurt School argues that basically social relations continue to become atomized, and you can see that with like social media, like how one goes about meeting someone is increasingly online. I think I can't remember the numbers again because I didn't think I would need to quote them, but I think it's something like 70% of all LGBT people admit to using some kind of online source for finding a partner, right?
70?
And
you know what they call the other 30%?
What?
Liars. Or partnered, I mean, maybe long-term partnered people also are in that cohort.
Yeah. It's a statistic that Pew has, researched, and, it covers like everything from like a hookup to, you know, long-term committed relationship. But again, I mean, the reason I bring it up is because that just goes to kind of show you how much that we rely on technology to meet each other. But the trade-off is it also kind of reduces us to pixels on a screen. And I've found, and some of my other work speaks to this, about how people treat each other almost like they're, you know, very much dispensable, right? Because you can just go on to the next profile. You can just go on to the next person and it doesn't, you know, really matter. And so, back to kind of the broader point I'm trying to make here is with QAnon offers people in society who are lonely, who are looking to be part of something bigger than themselves, a solution, right? Join our group, become, you know, one of the Anons. It's not explicitly stated, but it's definitely implied that like, hey, I'm offering you an explanation to why everything's so messed up in this world that is increasingly complex and hard for some people to understand. I'm offering you a community that you can be a part of, and I have a solution, right? You know, we just need to kind of, you know, post memes and wait around for the war. Or, you know, in the case of January 6th, take matters into our own hands and we can solve all these problems really quick, right? And so for, you know, this Midwest housewives, this looks really attractive.
I think that the one thing that QAnon, that the Q or whatever, they say there's only Q in the Anons because I don't know, they fucking don't want to be tarred and feathered with the term QAnon. But I think like the difference between this QAnon phenomenon, for example, chemtrails, the people that have been here for a long time know that we like to make fun of those people, is that the chemtrails, they might tell you who's at fault, but they don't have like a messiah figure. Whereas in the QAnon conspiracy theory, Donald Trump or maybe Michael Flynn or some combination of the, there's like a messiah figure, somebody who's going to come in and fucking fix everything. Mass arrests are coming. The white hats are coming. It's all, the storm is coming. And the storm was always Donald Trump was going to take down the people you don't agree with politically. And I think that that's the thing that distinguished this. Like once I realized that not only was there like, oh, it's those people over there, we got to blame them, but then there was like a messiah figure who was going to come get them. I'm like, oh, this is way more scary. This is way more frightening and has way more potential to leak off of the internet into the real world into some pretty dangerous ways.
So what's interesting in sociology is we have a lot of theories that talk about like leaderless social movements. And so for instance, like Black Lives Matter is it's a leaderless social movement. Anonymous, the hacking coalition is leaderless. But nobody, I think, predicted that there would be something on the right which would be a leaderless movement. And it's leaderless in the sense that, you know, Q's anonymous, but in a weird way, he's kind of hijacked the authoritarian personality of Trump, the kind of charisma that's necessary to kind of build a social movement and use it. What I worry about is that someone who's much more savvy than Trump, or maybe Trump himself, maybe he'll get someone in his orbit that knows how to wield this power in a really much more destructive way. You know, direct people to do kind of crazy things. And that's what's interesting to me too, is, you know, the Frankfurt School and even the Guy Debord, who wrote on this topic about the spectacle, they were interested in how the radio and multimedia, so cinema at the time, allowed authoritarian regimes to appeal to the masses, right? In Debord's case, he saw that motion pictures were basically hypnotizing people and getting them to believe whatever they saw, right? Because, you know, how could that be fake, right? And so the internet kind of taps into, and social media taps into some of that to an extent, and has a potentially very dark side that we should be all very, very wary of.
Well, and, you know, chat was like, oh, you know, is Q the leader? And I think I would call these, I would call them like almost like quasi leaderless, right? Because conspiracy movements, for, again, we'll go back to chemtrails because it's just the one that I know the most about. It's not that it's leaderless. It's that there's a bunch of small leaders, right? It's not like a top down thing, like a cult, like Scientology, where David Miscavige runs the cult of Scientology, or previously L. Ron Hubbard. Now there's like these sort of small nodes almost. It's almost like a peer-to-peer network instead of like a monolithic website. And so you have all these nodes where people are getting this information. It's oftentimes the same information, but there's no one leader of, you know, the Q movement or of the chemtrails movement or of the flat earth movement. You know, Q was supposedly the leader, but people never, like most people didn't get their information from the drops themselves. They'd go to the people they were calling bakers. And that would be basically someone like me explaining it to you. So like a person who's with their face on camera, you know, possibly a red light. Thank you for coming dressed to impress with that red light, by the way.
But and I have my ruby slipper in the back there too. So Oh, shit.
There's no place like home.
Exactly.
But people would be it's more like a distributed network. It's more like a thing like BitTorrent than like a download site. And so people are,
which is powerful, right? That's what, like that's a potentially like really new thing, and it's what gives it its strength. And it's why I'm so fascinated, because this thing is like an onion, right? It's layers upon layers upon layers, and you can just keep peeling it back, and it like doesn't seem to end.
Yeah, and the other thing is, like, when you have a distributed set of, like, I don't know, little demigods or whatever, one of them gets taken down by a scandal, the others are still there. So yeah. It's, you know, whereas if you have a monolithic thing, then if the leader gets taken down by a scandal, unless it's Scientology, I mean, I don't know what that dude would have to do to get those fucking zombies to leave that shit, the ones who are still left anymore. But it's more robust. It's the same reason that if you're downloading something via BitTorrent, even if the fastest node goes down, you can still get the thing, versus if you're downloading something from, you know, my website, and in my case, if Squarespace went down, you wouldn't be able to get the thing. And so it's more, not only is it more like robust, but also the churn of like ideas is quicker. The churn of crazy is quicker. And people then get into these parasocial relationships with more than one creator or more than one, small leader within the movement. And so I just think it just accelerates everything.
Yeah. And it's interesting too, because some of these influencers, like the, oh gosh, what's her name? The Gina woman, the dancing Gina.
Gina's the, not the QAnon one. It's Michelle Tytler. Gina's the just believes in aliens, and we love her and we want her to bake us a pie.
I was just kind of trying to draw a comparison. Like, some of these people are like really heartwarming people. Like, Gina's fucking, like, she could be my grandma, right? And I don't, so I'm, it's unclear to me. And actually, in the paper, we talk about how there's different levels of influencers. So there's people who are definitely grifters. They're selling a product. They're trying to make money off of it. There's people who are true believers who aren't in it for anything other than they think this is the thing, right? And then there's political leaders who have like kind of co-opted this movement for their own purposes, like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert and so many others.
And I think like the true believer to grifter thing is more of a spectrum, right? Where there are people who are like right smack in the middle of that, where they believe most of it, but they realize that if they present it in a certain kind of inflammatory way, that they're going to be able to make money on it. So like, it's not like either or. I think most of the politicians who are taking advantage of it are pretty damn close to the grifter side. I doubt Marjorie Taylor Greene is a true believer, you know?
Yeah. I mean, especially, you know, since she's walked back a lot of what she said, it seems to me that she's kind of reading the room and going, yeah, I better play it safe and kind of stay in the middle of this. I do have to give her at least some credit. She's very crafty in that regard.
QAnon it would be just another moral panic. Like if you could imagine, I think you're around the same age as I am, so you were probably young when the satanic panic was going on.
Yes.
And imagine if that would have happened on Facebook.
Yeah. We saw that, right? We saw that with the Killer Clown episode that happened. What was that? 2016, 2017, where all these people were thinking that clowns were coming to abduct their children on Halloween.
We had a clown on the show for our Halloween show just to like tell everybody that he wasn't coming after their kids.
You know, it sounds bizarre, right? But there were people who literally believed that, like, there were clowns getting beaten up out here in the Kansas City area. And, like, that's just messed up, right? Like, and that's the danger of a lot of this stuff, is people react in very strange and bizarre ways. And flirting with this stuff is very dangerous, because it can go into unexpected places.
And another thing that's like important with QAnon, and I think like kind of got almost like brushed under the rug, is there are not NGOs and charities and organizations that are like helping victims of child trafficking and helping try to expose people who are engaged in child trafficking and human trafficking more broadly. And I would guess that if we got one as somebody who was like just a, you know, worked for one of those organizations at, you know, during the 2020, they would have some fucking stories about phone calls that they took from people.
Yeah, and that would be really wild if you could get some of that.
I think somebody who works for that kind of organization would be very hesitant to speak publicly about any of that. I think that that's part of like being in that job, but it makes it harder for people who are actually trying to help the victims of, you know, human trafficking, because if people see a child trafficker, you know, under every politician's suit, and then they're going to jam up the phone lines for these places. And it's, you know, it seems small, but these places have very limited resources and they're doing a very tough job. That's probably pretty emotionally taxing. Then you have all these maniacs calling you about fucking Hillary Clinton eating a baby in a Frazzle Drip video or whatever. And it's like, it's going to break some of these people. You can only take so much. And I feel like it probably had a profound impact on like charities and community organizations trying to help with the actual real problem of human trafficking on this planet.
So what's interesting is, so my main area is criminology, and for like, I want to say like 3 or 4 years, there was a ton of money out there for people to do human trafficking research. And it was just so bizarre to me. So part of me wonders, like, Q's obsession with human trafficking, if that's not some kind of like deeper right wing kind of, and I know I'm kind of going conspiracy theory here, but like, you know, a lot of them fund that kind of research because they're trying to push some kind of broader agenda. And so there's part of me that wonders if, you know, there isn't some of that going into it. And also the other day, I was around someone and I mentioned, something about Chris Cornell, right? And Chester, what's his name, from Linkin Park. And he was like, yeah, they got killed because they were, you know, trying to stop human trafficking. And it was one of those moments where I was like, oh shit, he's one of them.
But that might be the only thing that person believes about QAnon. Do you know what I'm saying? You don't have to be all the way pilled. The thing about it is because it's like this big meta conspiracy, you could be like a chemtrails person and believe like the Q stuff. You could be a flat earther, although a lot of the Q people, to their credit, I suppose, were dunking on flat earthers for a while, which was odd. But yeah, you can, there's so much going on with it that you can just grab one little thing out of it. And then, you know, people start seeing you say like, oh, you know, Chris Cornell was killed because he was trying to stop child trafficking. And then what's going to happen online to that person is they're going to get love bombed by a bunch of fucking Q people. Like, and so those people are going to go, oh, you're so smart, you've cracked the code, blah, 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 blah. And after they fucking do that, they're going to start, that person might be exposed to other stuff within this kind of QAnon conspiracy, like metaverse or whatever. And they've just been like put in a suggestible state, basically. If somebody tells you that you're really smart and you fucking crack the code, we as human beings have a deep need to crack the code. And so you're going to have affection for that person, even if you've never met them, like a digital internet version of affection. And then they're going to be able to convince you of something else, or they'll be more likely to convince you of something else.
So, yeah. And so two things. One, so this particular individual, I've been kind of testing the water with them to see like, okay, you believe in this? Do you believe in this? And, the second thing is that I think is the true danger of QAnon, because I've seen things that have started out in QAnon in that community, and then it ripples out and it becomes ever so softer as it reaches like mainstream audiences. And then it pulls in your crazy aunt or whatever, who now is, you know, trying to fight child trafficking, and then, you know, hears about adrenochrome and she's like, oh my God, we got to stop this. This is crazy. This is satanic. The vaccine has the number of the beast. You know, that's the real danger. And that's why I'm really interested in this, in a kind of broader sense. I'm actually starting on a project with a grad student here on medical misinformation and looking at that. So that's going to be really interesting.
I think Ninja in our chat is also doing something. He mentioned it earlier, but you know, I'm rude and I don't really pay that much attention to my friends in chat, but he mentioned doing something similar as part of a, like he's in school doing research. I don't know, whatever. Ninja's been my internet friend forever, and I couldn't tell you a damn thing about him except that he's one of my favorite people and he has a couple kids. Seems like a great dad. But I think that there's going to be a lot of work that's going to come out about medical misinformation, and I think people are going to start finding the roots of a lot of it in the Q community, and it's the links are going to be tenuous, but it's going to be really interesting. Hopefully we get this COVID thing under control so that we can say was about it instead of is, so that you're not trying to report on, people aren't trying to do papers about something as it metamorphosizes and fucks our society up. But I think there's going to be a lot of interesting sort of through lines, because I think there could be just a simple way that this would flow would be, last summer somebody was sharing Save the Children memes, and they were like just your kind of totally regular person before that, and then they got kind of, you know, somewhat deep into QAnon, and then fucking like right around the first of the year the anti-vaccine movement comes in and swoops them up, and now they're like at these anti-vaccine rallies when they started as a person who probably wasn't anti-vaccine in the beginning and was just sharing Save the Children memes. That's oversimplified. There's a lot more steps going on in there, but there's just so many pathways in this particular, like in this particular pipeline for people. Like the top of the funnel is so big. I think of conspiracy theory and getting into it like a funnel. Like you catch a lot of people at the top, and the funnel will kick out people like along the way down the funnel, and you get to the bottom of the funnel, and most of the time there's a racist drawing of a Jewish person at the bottom of the funnel. Like you end up there, right? But it's the funnel just seems to have gotten so big now, like the top of the funnel, and it seems to be kicking less and less people out. It's odd.
Yeah, and part of that, I think, is this process that, you know, some of the Anons and some of the people who promote QAnon have kind of been trained to keep promoting more extreme stuff, right? Whatever gets eyeballs onto the screens and watching you. And so part of my work looks at like the rewards that we get as human beings for getting a like on Facebook, getting a share. You know, the people in neuroscience tell me that basically there's a dopamine response when that happens. And so for a lot of these conspiracy theorists, they've kind of been trained on how to basically promote themselves in a way that then has a psychological reward, that then has a social reward, that then basically keeps kind of feeding into this machine. And so they, at the end of the day, they all end up at the bottom of the funnel, you know, looking a lot like Alex Jones to some degree or another.
Yeah. How much time you've spent on Telegram, but right now it seems like people's Telegram groups are the bottom of the funnel.
Yeah. Yeah. I've spent a little bit of time on there. Since the papers come out, I've had to focus a lot more on teaching. One good thing that happened is, I tested my, crim class to see, like, you know, are the students really interested in this stuff? And so I ended up getting a lot of volunteer student researchers who are now going to start basically working for me to kind of catalog some of this stuff. And so one of the projects I'm working on now is looking at this kind of left-leaning version of QAnon. So, for instance, the people who are into yoga but also are into Q, or the people who have this alternative wellness connection and Q, because for me it's the same. Like, I see a lot of the same fundamental mechanisms that are used by authoritarian regimes to kind of boost their hold on people, and the way in which they kind of suck people in. And so we're basically cataloging some of these top kind of leftist QAnon influencers, and trying to understand, like, what are the mechanisms by which they're using, and how similar are they to more conventional people who promote this stuff, like Jordan Sather and Joe M and Praying Medic, like, is it the same? And if it's not, then what's different and how's it different?
I just have a couple recommendations for you on that. You may have already heard of a conspirituality podcast.
I love that.
Also, Bullshito. I don't know if you've listened to Frost's podcast.
Have not, but I will.
Yeah, he talks about he's like a martial artist, and he talks a lot about conspiracy theories spreading in martial arts. And there's like a lot of crossover between martial arts and kind of like new age communities, at least in cities. And so his show's really good. I've been trying to get him on here. I've been helping him out with his OBS and hoping to like parlay an interview with him out of that. His show's so good. He runs this forum for martial artists where they like debunk bullshit. And so it that's some good stuff. Also, you surely know about the Q Origins project. Robert, he makes a lot of his data public. A lot of the data he's pulled, he's made it public. So make sure that's Cunsterfuge. Make sure you check that out. I forget the like DM me or whatever afterwards, or like tomorrow actually, because I'll probably drink half a bottle of vodka tonight. But DM me tomorrow and I'll get you the link, because I think a lot of their raw data is just public.
Yeah, no, those guys have been great. In fact, in the acknowledgement section of the paper, I thank you guys and I thank them, because they actually, I did not expect this at all. I sent them the original paper because I was like, hey, look, you know, I'm a researcher, you know, check this out. And they sent me back. They like edited the paper and gave me a lot of really useful advice and some books. And so I was really like, you know, academics aren't as kind as they were to me. So
they are, as we would say, true believers. So they're going to help you.
Yeah, they're cool. They're cool people.
Well, good. Let's we'll do maybe 5 or 10 more minutes here. Tell us about your book, the one you showed. If you even showed on the screen too, even though it'll be red.
Oh, the Gaberhood?
Yeah, tell us about the book.
Oh yeah, so the Gaberhood, right? And so this is kind of, in some ways, this is the dissertation I wanted to write. So my dissertation was on electronic dance music and basically how it had become commodified via the culture industry. And I wanted to do a project on looking at how Gaberhoods and gay neighborhoods like the Castro and Boys Town in Chicago, how they had become basically commodified, and how they kind of lost their authenticity or their original core purpose. And so it's an edited volume, and so there's a bunch of different authors in here doing some really great work along a similar vein. So there's 12 chapters. The afterwards written by a journalist here in the Kansas City area, who kind of brings in a more rural perspective and how, like in rural places, there are gay communities, and they kind of emulate, different aspects of gayborhoods. And so, it's a really, I'm very proud of it. Spent a lot of time on it. And it kind of came out of this observation, if you will, that the fight and the struggle for gay rights is not over. In many ways, it's gotten worse because it's gotten harder to see where the fault lines are. And again, part of it is also my obsession with studying digital sociology, like studying life online and how that's eroding this public square. And so I've written a couple papers on Grindr and what Grindr is doing to like the gay community, and it's not good and it's ugly. And
it's making it easier for me to get what I want when I want it.
Well, I mean, yeah, there is that, but there's also a lot of racism and a lot of body shaming and a lot of other stuff. And so that's kind of what I write about, is how these apps, they say they bring us closer together, but do they, right? So basically kind of make it into an empirical question. So that's kind of the many streams of my work, and how they kind of, the overlap, they all kind of focus on this concept called the culture industry and how commodified culture taps into our irrational fears and desires and then preys on them in order to make money. And so so I guess I've looked at that from, like, you know, gay neighborhoods, from dance music and how it's changed, and now this, you know, conspiracy theory stuff with QAnon and how, you know, and that's kind of the real point of the paper at the end, right? Is I talk about how, you know, were it not for the algorithms leading, you know, your dear grandma down the rabbit hole, would this thing have exploded like it did? And I don't think it would have. I don't think it could have. It, like, the way in which Facebook uses information against us, it ends up, you know, basically promoting these really awful aspects of our culture.
Cool. And I guess the next thing you're working on is something on dance music. And I kind of like what I say about dance music is that, like, mainstream dance music in the 90s was a lot of black and brown people and a lot of queer people.
Yes.
And now it's a big fucking white boys club. And and, like, I don't know. You can't fake that funk. You got to have, like, a, you know, music scene, whatever it is, has to be like a diverse music scene. And if it's not, you're just going to miss out on so much in the music and so much of, like, what's out there. There's, I'm not saying, like, there is good dance music. I play current modern dance music, right? I have to play modern stuff. Otherwise I'll play the same 20 tracks forever. But you know, when you start looking at what's, like, really hot and what's drawing people to the festivals, it's been just like, it's been whitewashed completely.
Yeah. So that's exactly the point of my it's now going to be a book. I just have to write the damn thing.
Oh, but, is that all? Yeah. Writing a book is easy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, if I didn't have to teach so much, things would be a lot easier, but anyway, yeah, it, dance music really grew out of Chicago and Detroit. So in that sense, it is a very Midwestern thing. So maybe it's good I'm back in here. I don't know. But it was started by black and brown people in Chicago and Detroit who were basically trying to create a culture that spoke to them and felt like everything else was not doing the trick. And so, in the late 80s and early 90s, there was a huge kind of revolution. And again, the internet was kind of a part of that too, right? Changes in new communications technologies.
By the late 90s, by, like, the heyday of, like, the Oakland, San Francisco rave scene, yeah, the internet, you had to go, like, why wouldn't you look for the party on the internet at that point?
Yeah. And listservs, right? Yeah. As annoying as they were, that was the thing. And then actually you can blame Joe Biden for this. You know, he proposes the Rave Act, and then suddenly there's a shift and a move into the clubs, which then commodifies it, strips away the threatening parts. And then you have the rise of the festival scene, you know, in the 2010 era, and, you know, it becomes big business.
Yeah. And the other thing is, when you move it into the clubs, and people take from this what they will, you replace MDMA with alcohol. And I think that that's not a small factor in what's going on, at least at the clubs. Although, like, I don't know, there's a couple small clubs here in San Jose that I like to play at every once in a while, but otherwise, like, the big mega clubs and stuff, yeah, they've just, it's out of control. And the festivals, I don't know. I have no, like, desire to go. It just looks like a shit show concert, honestly. But I'd be interested in a concert that had both like, the funny thing is, as dance music got real popular, you're not seeing it at the big mainstream rock festivals, which is weird. And the same thing happened to hip hop. Like, you're not seeing a lot of hip hop at the big mainstream, like, music festivals with, you know, bands basically. And it's just kind of interesting that they haven't, they've, you know, it's gone completely mainstream, but you're not seeing much of it at, you know, the kind of, I don't know, there's a band on the stage, that kind of festival. And I wonder why that is.
So again, I kind of stopped collecting data back in 2015 because I finished my dissertation and I was over studying dance music. I'd spent, you know, 5 years on it. And, but I do know at, the EDM business conference, which was in Las Vegas, held basically the week before EDC, you had the founder of Coachella and some of these other bigger festivals, talking about how they're going to start incorporating dance music into their lineups. But, and I've seen some, but you're right there. Overall,
it'd be like Skrillex when Skrillex was bigger, like Diplo, it would be like one right. big act, big, yeah. big, you know?
Yeah. Well,
Chris, this is fun. I'm definitely going to have you on again. This, what, 50 ish minutes flew by. Before we get out of here, can you tell everybody where to find you on Twitter or where to maybe get that book that you just held up?
Yeah, well, so my publisher will hate me for this, but if you want to send me a DM at CONNER Sociology, and I can spam the chat when we get done here. So Connor Sociology on Twitter. I'll just send you a copy, but don't tell anybody. Because this is the thing about academic presses. We don't make any money off the books we write. We do it because of the bigger purpose. Yeah.
Well, great. And everybody follow our dude on Twitter. Also, if you're in Discord, you probably know who he is in our Discord. Chris, thanks again. Thanks again for joining me. Rock a tune real quick, and then we're going to get on to conspiracy bingo. I'll see you in the chat.
Thanks.